Welcome to the Chameleons Podcast. Are we currently experiencing the greatest cognitive revolution in human history? If so, how can we unlock our full potential and creative capacity with the help of AI and the incremental advancement of intelligence systems? These are some of the questions underlying my conversation with Stephen Messer, an active and successful serial entrepreneur, founder of Collective Eye, and co-founder of Linkshare. In this conversation, we dive into his mission to help people and companies prosper by building a foundation model for financial decision-making. We also discuss his thoughts on how to unleash our full potential through AI in companies and education, disruptive innovation, the road to artificial general intelligence, seed investments, and his close collaboration with his sister and his family. Stephen has an exceptional talent for identifying and activating new business avenues. I hope this interview can catch a glimpse of how a brilliant mind grasps opportunities from the deconstruction and reconstruction of complexities. Before we start, just a quick mention of a new sponsor. Nomono is a Norwegian company dedicated to improving and simplifying podcasting. Their portable sound capsule is easy and intuitive to use. You simply put on their Wi-Fi connected multi-track recorder, use the 4 high-quality wireless mics to record, and it gets automatically uploaded to your very own Nomono cloud, where the AI-powered audio enhancement provides exceptional audio quality. I used the Nomono portable podcasting kit to record this episode, and I will continue to use it in future interviews because I can't see how I would be able to continue podcasting without it. Check out their website on nomono.co. I highly recommend it. This is the Chameleons Podcast, and I'm your host, Imak Zambrana. And now, the interview with Stephen Messer. I'm really, really excited to talk to you today. So welcome to the Chameleons Podcast.
I'm excited to be on the podcast. Thank you for having me.
In many other instances, I've been introduced to amazing people by Nicole, our fellow friend.
She is amazing.
She is amazing. So shout out to her.
Always.
So I was thinking maybe we could start with a little background introduction of you, and maybe you would like to share who you are and how this journey of yours started in tech and with your companies.
I think, look, my background is going to be pretty standard for anyone who likes tech, which is if you were a kid who loved programming, dumpster diving for parts and building your own computers, you were the kind of kid that didn't play football, didn't go play lacrosse, you know, was not out there playing soccer every day. You were the kid who was very happy trying to figure out how stuff worked. And so every toy you got, you probably broke to find out how it worked. And then tried to figure out, could you put it back together? I'd probably say today, in today's day and age, you're probably the kid who's playing with a Raspberry Pi, trying to figure out how to program your own toy. And you find that way more interesting than almost anything else that's out there. And that's sort of the world I grew up in. My father originally bought a mini computer from Digital back in the day, had no idea how to use it. It had eight and a quarter, I'm trying to remember back then, but 8 1/4 floppy drives, and you had to program it yourself. And he sat me down and said, learn. And which was awesome. And I sat there, and I could have sat there every day, passed on school in a heartbeat, and just sat there programming at the computer, and then started building my Apple, you know, two, and by building out an extension of it, and then started dumpster diving for parts because they were too expensive. And it just went from there.
So your father, he was also a computer scientist?
Not at all. He was a real estate guy, but he... You know, he was an early adopter by his nature. He liked everything new. Mm. Same with my mother. I had a sister. We all grew up the same way. And we just kind of got into it. And that's how we we kept going. And then sadly, he passed when we were very young, but it never left us. We always kept playing with every piece of new technology and spent our lives trying to figure out how this stuff worked.
So your sister is also in the same field, right?
I work with my sister. Yeah. No, I work with my sister. And I work with my brother-in-law. Heidi and I started our first big company, Linkshare, together. And I'm very fortunate because Heidi's much smarter than I am. And that's not putting me down. I think I'm an extremely smart guy. So trust me, there's no humility. But Heidi is on a different level. She's amazing.
So you mentioned Linkshare now. So you guys started that together?
Heidi and I started that together in 96. Heidi had been working at a law firm called Baker Botts after graduating from Harvard Law. And Baker Botts was really the outsourced deal group for a guy named John Malone, which if you're in Europe now, you know who John Malone is because he runs the largest cable company out of all of Europe. And at the time, he had built a small cable company into the largest U.S. cable company called TCI. He owns a content group called Liberty, which if you like Formula One, they're now owned by Liberty. And so Heidi was on the deal team that was doing deals with them. And Heidi and I got together to start with two other co-founders to start Linkshare. And that became our first big business that we built together.
So what did you do in Linkshare?
So Linkshare dominates a field called affiliate marketing. I think when we sold it to Rakuten in 2006, we were probably 98% of the affiliate market. I mean, it was ridiculous. We just dominated. An affiliate is basically a commission-based way of making money. So if you have a website and you promote someone else's products, a Dell computer on the website, and someone clicks on a link, goes to Dell and buys that computer, you get a commission. And Linkshare made all of that work. Wow. And today, there's not a content creator out there. There's not a browser plugin. There's not a blogger, you name it, that doesn't rely on affiliate marketing to make revenue. And it all is behind the scenes. It just enables everybody to win. And that was what was so great about it.
How did you figure out that that was what you wanted to do? And how did you come up with the idea?
You know, I think most new mediums, and we'll talk about this when we get to AI too, but most new mediums start off with the bias of what people are already familiar with. And so when the internet really was springing up, 94, 95, 96, when Mosaic and the first few browsers were coming up, everybody looked at the medium like it was TV or magazines. That was the debate. That's why, you know, Mark Cuban had broadcast.com. His idea was you could actually see broadcasts, like a television station. You could see it. Or Time Warner had a group called Pathfinder early in the days. And they were trying to create magazines online. They wanted to recreate the magazine experience that people loved through the browser, which, of course, today looks insanely stupid, right? The idea that if I wanted a magazine, I'd get a magazine. Why would you have you have to boot up a computer. You can't take it on the plane as easily. It was really painful.
Or lie in bed with it.
And so the entire web was designed for advertising, which is how magazines made their money, which is a really interesting idea if you're a passive medium. So if you think about radio, television, newspapers, and magazines, what they all have in common is I can see an ad and flip the page. It doesn't mean I'm going to go leave what I'm doing, right? When I'm watching Seinfeld on TV, if there was an ad for McDonald's, I wasn't leaving Seinfeld. I had a limited time window, 30 minutes to watch the show. It wouldn't get on reruns for years later. And so the commercial could be shown, but I would stay on my couch. I wouldn't run to go to McDonald's. I'd stay and wait and make it through Seinfeld. And then when I'm done, maybe I'll go get McDonald's. But I'm building brand attention. But there's no action you can take on any of those mediums. But the internet, well, if I see an ad for McDonald's and they'll have it at my house in 5 minutes, if I click on it, I'll pause whatever I'm watching and I'll go do it. Links are designed to be active. And so everybody was building this internet for this passive medium. And we looked and said, this is insane. And so what ended up happening was there were real repercussions to this. The early websites, Yahoo, Lycos, all these websites that were springing up were designed around this idea that they were going to aggregate a huge audience and then advertisers would pay in traditionally what's called CPM, cost per mil, cost per thousand. So for every 1,000 people who see this thing, they're going to pay for that and that's how they're going to make money. And what that meant was the top 50 websites that were out there were getting 95% of all the ad revenue. And while they were the top 50 websites, they accounted for less than 2% of the web's overall traffic.
Wow.
Again, traditional television had a few channels. Cable maybe added another 100 channels. Magazines, maybe there's 100 magazines. But the internet had millions of websites. They couldn't get paid anything simply because they weren't in the top 50, even though in aggregate, they represented more traffic than those top 50 combined could ever get. So we looked at that and said, okay, we have to solve that. And the way we solved it was the logic underlying CPM means that how do I, as an advertiser, do I guarantee that I got my traffic? In television, they used Nielsen. They looked at 1,000 households and they said this is what they were watching. They extrapolated out what that was. In magazines, they knew how many subscriptions people had and they knew how many people were buying those magazines. Mm. Same thing with newspapers, et cetera. So advertisers have gotten used to that. In the web, you didn't need to have that. What if instead of charging upfront, you said, look, I'm going to pay you on a performance basis? And this is not something that was brand new. In the US, there is a very famous commercial or infomercial from the 80s. It was from a product called the Ginsu knife. You probably wouldn't mind it.
No,
you wouldn't remember it. But here's what was going on. All the cable guys were out there and they were laying all this cable before fiber, coaxial cable. And originally what cable TV was designed to do was rebroadcast. If you live in New York, like where we're at today, because of all the tall buildings, you couldn't get broadcast TV. Wow. In fact, most buildings would have one antenna on the top and they would create cable inside so that its residents could see television because all the buildings were blocking the signal. So cable came up as a way for people who lived in a valley. If you were in a valley surrounded by mountains, you couldn't get television. So they would put a TV, an antenna up on a hill, and they would run cable and they would rebroadcast television. That was how it all started. For $2 a month, you can actually get a good signal because they would do that. And that was fine, but it wasn't very profitable. So what they realized is in the coaxial cable, they could actually have lots more stations. Problem was there was no content. So in the late 80s and 90s, all the cable guys started buying up content, which was very expensive. You're buying MGM's library of movies to show people, that's fine, but how do you make money? Well, they were trying to sell advertising. But the advertisers were like NBC, CBS, all these major cable, that's where all our money's going. So then they had to figure out, how do I make money now that I've gotten people there? And you may find it funny, but one of the first cable stations was just a camera facing a clock.
Which clock?
It was
what?
Just a clock.
A clock?
So you could always get the time.
Wow.
You could have your TV on and have the time. Another one was facing a fireplace. They were trying to fill content, but content's very expensive. So a really smart guy came up with this idea. He said, look, I have an idea. I want to sell this knife and I will create entertaining content. And what I'll do is I'll create an 800 number for every, what's called an MSO, every cable system. And there'll be a call center there, not run by me, but run by some third party call center. And we'll keep track of everything they buy through that 800 number. And we'll know how to pay you a percentage of sale. Now think about this to the cable guys.
Wow.
Cable guys are thinking to themselves, every minute I have to buy content is expensive. So this guy is willing to produce content that's entertaining, maybe not be the most entertaining, may not be Gone with the Wind, but it'll be entertaining. That saves me 30 minutes of paying for content. And not only that, he's willing to pay me if they sell anything. So this guy goes and puts this very fun commercial together called the Ginsu knife, and he can cut through tin cans and still slice onions, and it goes on and on, but it's really entertaining. It's really funny. And this thing produces ungodly amounts of cash for the cable guys.
Wow.
And this becomes cable shopping, QVC, HSN. Barry Diller, who's a very famous media tycoon, becomes well known for creating a shopping channel.
Wow. I remember that.
All those stations where they were selling jewelry and everything else, what happened is those started off as hour-long content that turned into 2, 3, 4 hour because it was really inexpensive.
And people would directly buy or start to buy. It would generate income.
We looked at this model and said, this is the same problem the internet has. People are reading content. They're reading, you know, some guy who's a gamer might be writing a website about gaming, can't make any money because he's not the big Yahoo with all the traffic. But meanwhile, people who are going there learning about gaming want to know what gaming systems he likes because he can pre-configure it. If you ever had to go buy a computer in the old days, my God, they would ask you what video card. And most people didn't know what they wanted. They just wanted a computer. So here's a guy who can configure a computer at Dell, say this is the ultimate gaming computer, and people just click on a button now, pass through Linkshare so we can do the 800 number equivalent to know which website sent them. And when that person buys a computer at Dell, we can calculate a commission. Now, you're talking about a $3,000 computer. That can be a pretty hefty commission. And this is what spread. Millions of websites started realizing they could make money with really good name companies like Dell and Disney and all these other 800 flowers and all these amazing companies. And those great companies made them look like they were real because they were well-known names.
Yeah.
But they were also making money off of them, and they started to become really good. And today, when you look at most of the websites you use, most of the bloggers, most of the promoters, most of the content creators, etc., they are all living off of making money by doing this for a living. It's worked really well.
Gosh.
And in fact, it made us really proud because over the 10 years we built that business before we sold it to Rakuten, what was really amazing was we created a system that empowered people to be independent, to make money and be successful completely on their own without the need of having to beg for it. It was basically automated business development.
Yeah.
Imagine trying to do a deal with Disney. You might spend a year trying to convince Disney that your website should be used. And you've got someone there who thinks in biz dev, they're going to decide if they should or shouldn't work with you. Well, our system eliminated that. You could go and sign up, promote Disney. And if it turned out you had a great idea, you could be unbelievably successful, but without needing someone to judge whether it was worth it. And that business development person at Disney used to have to sit there and figure it out because it would take so long to get a legal deal done, et cetera. By automating it all and bringing the cost down, it meant anybody could end up being successful. And it turns out a lot of them were.
Wow. Did you have to go through, or kind of you do the legal part with Disney or those companies?
So we standardized all of it, which in the beginning was very hard because not a lot of people wanted... You know, you go to Disney and say, here's a standard affiliate agreement. They would look and say, I hear you, but we're Disney. Mm. You know, we're the mouse that roars. Like, are you kidding me? We tell people what to do. And we would say, okay, then don't do it. And we would say for every time, and a lot of times in the beginning, they would say, fine, if we can't do it, we're going to have to review each one individually. Mm. We would say, go ahead. And after about 2 or 3 months, they would realize, why am I doing this? This is insane. These guys are all trying to build businesses. No one's trying to destroy Disney's brand. They're all trying to build big businesses. And it was self-selecting. If I had, you know, because their big fear was pornography, whatever. And,
yeah.
But how much Disney stuff are you going to sell on pornography websites?
None.
They didn't want it. It was performance-based.
Mm.
Whereas advertisers would try to scam the advertisers. And if Disney was a big payer, they would be like, oh, it's a great audience. And then they would discover things. In performance marketing, you didn't have any of that. Those people, trust me, they were making a lot more money. They didn't need Disney to make money. So what would happen is they would focus on people who wrote kids' stories. You know, you had all these great authors who were creating websites with kids' stories, podcasts that would read kids' stories. And then they would want to promote Disney to make money off of. And it was a great partnership. And it was a great way for Disney to find people promoting their products in ways they never even dreamed.
Right.
And it was just empowering.
Wow. Suddenly they had all these commercials in every area.
They were getting millions and millions of websites promoting Disney in really interesting new ways that were in context that a marketing group could never have done. And they were making more money. And what was shocking to most of these companies were their online advertising would maybe account for 10 or 15%, but it'd be a huge budget that they would spend. And usually within 6 months to 9 months, we were probably 20 to 30% of their revenue, and they were paying only a commission. And it would keep growing at a faster rate than anything else.
Brilliant idea.
Well, wow. I think what's cool about that is you're really just unlocking human capacity to be creative from all the restrictions that take place when big companies get involved and politics kick in.
Yeah.
And people generally are good. And when they're compensated for doing great things, my God, you can see people doing the most creative, amazing things. And that's what we loved watching, these millions of affiliates coming up with ideas, helping each other out, sharing ways of growing it. That was really cool. And today it empowers people to be independent.
Yeah.
And I think that's really amazing.
That's so cool. And you sold it. Why did you? Or what happened there?
Well, there's nothing bad. I mean, we sold it for $500 million. It was a pretty good transaction.
Pretty good,
I think we were pretty happy with the outcome.
Yes.
I think what happened was we had tried to go public in 1999 and the market crashed. Now, that was a good thing because those were some pretty bad years that followed. If you were in the public markets in 2000, 2001, 2002, for the most part, your stock was destroyed.
Oh.
And I think it ended up at the time being bad, but it ended up being a good thing overall.
Right.
By 2005, we were thinking it's time to go public. Company has grown really quickly, and it was growing very fast, and we dominated the market. I mean, there was no one competing with us at that point. We had just taken over. And
you were the first kind of mover as well in a market, right?
I think we were the first mover. Amazon launched almost a week and a half after we did. They were probably the main competitor that still exists. We had two other copycats that came out. They didn't survive. There was no chance. We had a better business model. We really built a better infrastructure. I think they were fighting an uphill battle. They raised dramatically. I think we raised $20 million in total. I think when you combine all of my competitors, they probably raised $500-600 million, and they just got devastated. Wow. But look, what was nice about the business was by 2005, we were getting ready to go public again. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening was, as we were going through that process, a lot of people started picking their head up and wanting to buy us. And look, I think for any entrepreneur, it's both an exciting thing and a sad thing to sell your business. But I think it was the right thing for the business. We were very big in Japan through a joint venture with Mitsui. We were just starting to expand heavily in Europe. And we expected that would be a big battle. And Rakuten was a perfect match. They were trying to get into the U.S. They were run by a really great entrepreneur, Hiroshi Mikitani, who's a super guy. And so it was nice because we had a big Japanese entity and they were sort of the Yahoo, eBay of Japan. They were trying to get in the U.S., so we allowed them to get into the U.S. as well. And it was a profitable, fast-growing business that had really high barriers to entry. So it gave them the ability to get a team and a group in the U.S. And they've done a great job since then. They've really built up that market and it's been successful. I think it was a great deal for everyone.
And so after that, when you sold the business, what happened after that? How did you figure out what to do next?
I think, look, we decided to move on because I think sometimes there's a point where as you're merging these two businesses, they take on the culture of the new parent, which is what it should. And I think the founder, in this case, I think there's different problems when you get acquired. I think I'll share. When you get acquired by a U.S. corporation, you're always going to have a clash of culture when you have a founder and a big corp where what you've done as a founder goes against big companies. And I would say, you know, it's funny, eBay probably did it best in the early days. The way eBay used to do it when they would acquire a company is overnight, they would send a team in, they would repaint the walls, eBay colors, they would replace everyone's badges. So by the time the new people came in, they found it was an eBay company, and they would take the senior managers. They would say, look, brief us on what's going on. We're going to put our own managers in. And I think that's smart.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. Founder mentality is about reinvention. It's about disruption and breaking it. Large companies are about perfecting something. And I think they're both necessary at different times, but I don't know if the cultures work. Mm. So I, for example, have this aversion. When a company gets acquired, I think a lot of the big companies come in there and think you should do a earnout to make the founder stay. Now, I think that's insulting in a lot of different ways. I think, one, it's stupid for the company that does it. I think they've been told to do it. It's a very business school thing, and I used to teach at Columbia Business School. Mm. So trust me, I can tell you these stupid ideas become things that teachers talk about. but I think it's stupid because, one, if I were recruiting my top talent, would I try to lock them in or would I try to create incentives for them to do the thing I want them to do? So when they're recruiting a CEO or a CFO or any other major role that they need to fill in their organization, they're trying to create a compensation structure that motivates someone to do what they need. And you're usually negotiating the types of resources that they'll need to accomplish it, not in acquisitions. In acquisitions, they try to take part of the purchase price and punish the founder. And they do that through earnouts and lockups. So they'll say the company is worth $100 million. Let's use an easy example. Now, the investors who probably came in later than the founder, who put cash in, not time, energy, and effort, they'll say at the end of that, let's say they own 50%, they'll say, take your $50 million, you're free to go. But they'll say to the founding group, and all the, you know, top employees, we're going to take that $50 million. Let's say the founder's got 10 of it or whatever. I'm making that up. Mm. They'll say, look, we're going to have to put $5 million of that in escrow, and we need you to stay for 3 more years. Now think about the math of that. The first thing is I'm going to treat you, founder, worse than the investors because I'm not asking them to do a three-year holdup.
No.
Two, what is it saying about what I want from you? It means they're saying my motivation is to lock you up so you can't leave. Now, they may put some earnout, like revenue goals on there, but the reality is they're saying to someone, I want you to stick around. I don't want you to do your magic. I don't want you to do the thing that built this company. I'm not going to motivate you to help me fill in the missing entrepreneurial spirit that I might need in my company, or I need this product helped, so I'm going to motivate you. They're saying, I want you to stick around, and if you don't, I'm going to hold money back from you. And I want you to behave like everybody else who's got a, you know, a job employment contract. Well, you're taking a stallion and trying to make it a plow horse.
Yeah.
And I think that's why these things end up going so badly.
So what often happens then?
Almost always they end up in litigation. Founder says, I couldn't hit my revenue number because you didn't give me the resources you promised. You prevented me from doing these things. It goes to litigation. They end up getting their money anyway, but after a brutal fight. I think the smart CEOs of those companies should sit there and figure out, how do I motivate you to do what you did here? But I'm buying you because I couldn't have done this on my own. So is there some part of my business I need you to recreate?
Freedom.
Freedom. Now that's if you're acquired by a company. In our case, we were acquired by another great entrepreneur. And I think it's important to recognize that if you have a great entrepreneur, having two of them can sometimes be challenging because we both are trying to reinvent the world.
Yeah.
And Hiroshi did a great job and he was the acquirer.
Wow.
So we eventually moved on.
Amazing. So, yeah, and you got freedom to do the next thing.
We ended up going out to do the next thing, and which is what we did. And we started Collective Eye, which is short for collective intelligence. And we tend to like network models, and we tend to like businesses that are disruptive. 9 years ago, when we started that company, neural nets were not the thing that people cared about. In fact, I would promise you, if you talk to Sam and Ilya over at OpenAI, if you talk to Demis over at DeepMind and Mustafa, who now has Inflection, and you ask them, what do people think? They will tell you how it was impossible to raise capital, that nobody thought this idea would work, that neural nets had come and gone in the past, that maybe they'll be something, but I don't know. And even though there were companies like Google that were going out there and telling people, we are now an AI company, we're not an engineering company, I think most people just ignored them.
Wow.
And but today it's now a thing that everyone looks at and likes. And we're fortunate because we have 9 years of a head start and an advantage. And we understand this business better than most people do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was an opportunity for us to hopefully create another massive market and make our lives meaningful.
Right. And the mission of Collective Eye is?
What we look at is we find it weird that in 2023, almost 2024, that the economy is still run by the invisible hand that Adam Smith spoke about 300 years ago. It is a strange thing, and it is a really bad thing for society. Every time there is a recession, great recession, since no one wants to call them depressions anymore, you know, what it does to people and their livelihoods, how it sets back people who are maybe not wealthy, what it does to create economic divide, what it does for someone who wants to put their kids through school, what it does for everyone is really hard. And what it is everybody is making these gut calls based on bias and limited information. The Yes. federal government uses three-month-old beige books to decide what's going on in measures that are trailing to decide how they should deal with inflation and interest rates. That has a huge impact on how people can borrow, what it costs for people to pay off their credit cards. That's massive. Company CEOs hire economists who are worse than weathermen in making decisions on what's going on. They have to read magazines, newspapers, which influence them because all news now is for the most part propaganda for one party or another. And they're making decisions about hiring and firing that are pretty dramatic. If you were to think about the last 4 years, every quarter there has been a once in a lifetime event that's happened every quarter. World War III with Russia, COVID, a mass pandemic that shut down the economy for 2 years, inflation, interest rates going up, going down, money being thrown out at people, pulled back rapidly. I mean, it is crazy. You've had work from home that took place over the span of 3 months. You know, all of a sudden, all business is being done through video conferencing. It is a crazy situation that's going on, and it's only accelerating craziness.
Yeah.
So why in the world are people making decisions by how they feel in any given moment that affect millions and millions of lives. So the idea behind Collective Eye is short for what its name is, collective intelligence. We built a neural net, what's now called a foundation model. So for your audience to understand, a neural net is like a child's brain. It has all the neurons, but no information. A foundation model is a trained neural net. So when you hear someone say, I'm a doctor, that neural net has been trained on medicine by reading papers, research, understanding the human organisms, and understanding symptoms mean X and Y, and they're really going through that. Now, humans have general intelligence, which means I can also ride a bike home, et cetera. But these neural nets become super intelligence around one category. So ours is really understanding the transactional world. How is business being done every single day? And how do we analyze that so that we can make better predictions, you know, from everyone, from the salesperson who's trying to figure out, will this deal happen and when and how much will it happen for, to companies who want to understand what revenue is coming in, when, what is going on, to economists who want to understand what does this mean for our overall economy.
Wow. And so you provide this information on all those levels
on
to,
level.
For instance, a company, and they would be a client?
A company would be a client. They would contribute the data from systems like CRM and ERP and conversational things where the salespeople are talking to their email or phone or video conference. They would contribute this to our network. We would use this in a big pool to learn. It's called training data.
Yeah.
And we would learn across every company that uses us, like Waze. Have you ever used Google Maps or Waze?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when you're using Waze, it's giving you good directions, but at the same time, it's taking information from your phone to understand what road you're on, how fast you're traveling, what's going on, if there's a policeman there or not. And in combination with everyone else who's driving on the road, it understands what's happening to make better predictions and navigate you around traffic.
Right. So you take data from the entire business world, in a way, in addition to that particular company.
We'll use that to make better predictions for their individual personalized business without ever disclosing anyone's information. The AI is learning just the same way Waze doesn't tell you who's on the road, but it's learning from everyone. And it's taking this massive data set to understand, give you a personalized result to say, this is the best route for you today. Here's when you should expect to arrive. We do the same thing, but down to the business level.
Oh, wow.
And the goal is to help them optimize that, but also make better decisions. The amount of impact on people's lives today that are being made on very small amounts of data. You know, there's two venture capital firms, Sequoia and Benchmark. Every time there's a stock market crash, they immediately tell all their founders to fire everyone and basically fire 25% of your staff, buckle down, it's going to be 2 years before you can raise money. And they've been wrong probably 8 out of 10 times. Now they're right, but it's like a broken clock, right?
Yeah.
It's right twice a day. They keep telling people, when COVID first came out, they told people drop 25 to 30% of your staff. Well, the Fed threw money at the problem and the economy took off. So all those people, imagine you have 100 people in your company, 25 of them are laid out. Now magnify that by 1,000 people. 250 are laid off. Well, they had to turn around a month later, 2 months later, and rehire those people because venture capitalists are supposed to be the smartest people in the and they were creating chaos, havoc to people's lives and to the companies they were supposed to help with.
And society.
And every magazine and newspaper will publish it because it's a great thing. It's, you know, it's shocking. Oh my God, this is what's happening. But they've been wrong so many times, nobody should listen to them.
Right.
If you had a doctor give you that kind of, the malpractice lawsuits on them. And yet this is what they were saying for. And now, so this is, but it's not their fault. Their job is to get attention. Their job is to try to take a conservative approach. They're meant to protect their LP's money. And so they're trying to do what's in the venture capitalist's best interest.
Yeah.
But what that means for those 250 people got laid off, multiplied across all network. What it meant for the companies that missed the revenue and couldn't support their growth. These are all horrible things because people are trying to be smarter than everyone else. And we think that's a crazy model. So this is what we've been working on for 9 years. And it works unbelievably well. And we work with some of the biggest companies in the world.
So could you really tell me some of the names or what kind of sphere, what kind of fields are they in? Any field?
We've been doing this for 9 years. So
yeah,
you're talking about we track 5% of the globe's economy.
Oh,
so
gosh.
It is a massive data set. So I think the thing to pay attention to here is more that we really, the thing, I think the thing that Heidi, Tad, and I do really well, and I think where we've been able to attract great talent around it is we recognize that there's a disruption in the market because of a new technology. And we accept the technology for what it is. We're not trying to take the current world and fit it in a new paradigm. So the example of Linkshare, where everyone was trying to make it advertising from television, which broke immediately. That's what led to Linkshare. In the same way that people are trying to take this AI and say, oh, it's still software as a service. It is not. This is a cognitive revolution. The world will look back and think SaaS was the dumbest period of time of software that existed. Software as a service is a workflow tool. AI destroys all workflow. Have you ever used ChatGPT?
Of course,
yes. What's your workflow for ChatGPT?
Okay, so I would use it more like a conversational partner.
Interesting, but there's no workflow.
No workflow. It's more like I would go deeper. I would play with it a lot.
Yes, you're doing a cognitive thing. When people, when you and I are chatting,
yes,
we're going back and forth.
Right.
We're playing with ideas.
Right.
We're manipulating ideas, but there's no workflow.
No. Right.
No, it's a cognitive, in many ways, it's a super intelligence for what you're asking about.
Right.
So you have the ability to interact with it to get to an optimal outcome. It's actually elevating your skill.
It is. Yes.
It's the reason why in law school they teach the Socratic method. The more you go back and forth, the more you flush out an idea. Mm. And workflow was designed to do the opposite. Workflow software from the 80s that were brought into software as a service, these CRM-like products or, you know, Monday and all these tools, what they were designed to do was to take the dumbest person, put them in a very strict workflow, in other words, build fences, so that they could be average.
So they could just do what they need to do, like...
How do I make sure the dumbest person in my company
can
get something done because they're forced to do it a consistent way? But AI is different. AI is trying to give people superpowers. I'm trying to take, whether it be your dumbest person to your smartest person, and how do I elevate them beyond anything they could have ever done before? And this isn't the first time it's happened. Think about the Industrial Revolution. Can you run 55 miles an hour?
No.
Okay. Can you travel great distances for hours?
No.
You need brakes, right?
Yeah.
But when they came out with the automobile versus a horse, what it enabled people to do is we don't even think twice now about the superpower of traveling 55 miles an hour without even thinking about it. In fact, we get frustrated when we get stuck in traffic doing 10 miles an hour, which is 2 miles an hour faster than we could walk or run.
Yeah.
And so imagine that.
We take it for granted.
How about the superpower of flying? Something we could never have done before. The hydraulic piston allowed us to create backhoes and diggers and all these other things that allow us to build things that we could never have built before. How long would it take people to build a ditch or dig a foundation for a building like the one we're in now? Huge amount of time. How long does it take a machine to do it? Fraction. With a fraction of the people. We've been through these kind of revolutions before for our muscles and physical. That was the last 100 years. We're now getting that same kind of superpower for our brains. And if you think about it, we have now a lot less people making our food.
Yeah.
We have a lot less people doing construction, but everyone's at full employment. So what it is it's giving us this cognitive superpower that's going to empower us to do the next great thing. But that means we're moving away from workflows to deal with people who are the slowest in our work.
Yeah.
We're actually unleashing what we could do before. And that's...
Wow.
That's the power of AI.
It's mind-blowing, really.
So that's why you see we're building these things that seem... If I said to you we're building the economic engine for the next 50 years... It may seem like a huge thing, but think about what's happened quickly. In our lives, when we think cognitively, we think first Google, right? In 2000, 1996, 2000, you know, right around that time frame, they organized the web, the world's information. Recently, Uber came out. How long did it take for them to organize the world's transportation? Not long,
no time,
right? Didn't
no
take
time.
Long at all,
no.
right? And
no
it, we can keep looking at OpenAI. We can keep looking at all these things. In other words, all these things can happen very quickly. So our job, we do our job well, is in the next 5 years, the economies of the world, the corporations of the world, the individual workers of the world will have some sense of what's going to happen to make better financial decisions for their lives. And if we can do that well, we've done our job.
Yeah, and also creating consistency, a much more stable market, stable life,
there
society.
There may always be, you're a cognitive neuroscientist, right? You know, that's part of the market.
Cognitive scientist.
But you yourself know that that part of the economy's ups and downs is a part emotional. That may still be there, but the heights and the troughs maybe really come really thin because they're actually able to scientifically understand what should we do. Or they may be able to say, we don't need to drop money from helicopters the way they did during COVID, but maybe these parts of the economy need support to keep it from being a real drought or a big height.
Yeah.
And I think that's, instead of having these sort of, you know, burn the ship moments, you know, you can actually start being really targeted in the way you can operate to make the economy operate more effectively.
Yeah. I really liked what you said with regards to data access. In order to make a good decision, lots of decisions are taken without proper information and proper knowledge. And at the same time, it's so, with AI, the potential to widen your scope of understanding because you have this other entity that could supply you with information you could never have gathered alone or even as a team. It's not possible. So suddenly you have the capacity of the whole population, you know, the entire world in one decision. And it's just beautiful.
And these are critical. These are critical. Yeah. The world can't progress until these are in place. For example, Uber or Lyft could not have existed if Waze did not exist. Uber enabled, in the old days of taxis, you hired taxis because they knew all the streets of where you're going.
Yes.
Today, you can have a driver who came from another country, doesn't know a single street, but knows how to drive, and now they have a livelihood that they can make thanks to Uber finding them their ride and Waze or Google Maps directing them on the best route. And that means what they're doing now is just spending time on the experience. When's the last time you've gone on Uber that didn't have water, that didn't have mints, that didn't have charger cords? Like, think about the elevation of what that meant. So that now it enables you to do a work call from the back because you don't have to worry about running out of your battery. Mm. You don't have to worry about getting nauseous because you don't have a water if you're stuck in traffic. Mm. Like, they've literally made the experience so much better thanks to incrementing these systems of intelligence that are now bringing it all together because they're starting to combine. This is how I believe we'll get to artificial general intelligence.
You think so? What are the missing links now? And what do we need to develop in order to get there, do you think?
So if you ask the technologists, they'll all argue about one giant machine that can behave like we can. Mm. But here's the deal. Even we as humans don't have more than one expertise. And the reality is you need data and training data to do it. So what I actually believe is going to be is in the same way our brain has different kinds of functions and different sections of our brain, I think what's going to happen is you'll probably have different foundation models for different areas and probably one or two foundation models for each area that becomes the expert. And then you'll have a layer on top that knows where to ask for the information. And that's how we'll get to this sort of super intelligence.
Yeah.
That we're all hoping for.
A lot of different machines that are connected, like our senses are, through kind of a larger body.
Yeah, through an internet. That's the internet will act as the spinal cord, connecting all these different pieces together and trading information, allowing decisions to be made.
I think so too. And it's fascinating now. I love where you have multimodal solutions where you start to think like, how can I integrate, for instance, the understanding of or the decoding of written language with, for instance, sound or video. And you can put them together and you start to almost simulate how a human being taking the information.
Yep.
Whenever we talk to each other, like, or we sit here now and I take in, there's so much more than your voice. Like the way you express yourself, there's a energy in the room, all of that. And I wonder if we are able to replicate that kind of multimodal experience.
It will be soon.
Yeah, I think so too.
It should be soon. It's not when. It's not a question of if. It's definitely a question of when.
Yeah.
But I think it's more about getting humans to the place where we understand this is where we're going. And I think you know, a lot of the debates that we see today are fear-driven debates, almost always driven to drive monopolies in the AI providers.
Mm.
And I think this is, if anyone's fallen for it more, it's Europe.
Yeah, I know.
And Europe's becoming a third world.
It's interesting. You see what's going on in the EU.
It's so sad.
And also, I actually find it fascinating from a global perspective. We have so many countries that don't have access to technology still.
Yeah.
And all these kind of limitations and all these regulations will also stop us from sharing.
Well, I'll say this.
Yes.
I'll say thank you to the Europeans because you're sending all your best and your brightest to America because it's the only way they can practice what they do. And so you're basically guaranteeing America being the leader in the world. So we are so grateful for that.
And we're very appreciative.
What it means for Europe, sadly, is they will continue to fall further and further behind. And not just in the use of the technology, but the understanding of why you do what you do. So I think, I'm German. Clearly, my last name is Messer.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Well,
wow.
I'll say something that will probably upset your German listeners. Yeah. So they don't need to hate me, but I'm just trying to be truthful, which is Germany has had a history in the last 100 years of double downing on bad ideas to their demise. Mm. World War I, World War II, clearly, and I would argue GDPR and their new laws on AI. They really believe that they're doing right while falling further and further behind. And I would say that even here in the US, our privacy advocates have done the exact opposite of what they were setting out to do. With the elimination of cookies in the US, they've guaranteed hegemony over monopolies by Google, Facebook, and Apple, which was, I don't think, their point, because those were the players they hate the most.
Right.
But by eliminating it, they forced every advertiser to work with three players who have all the data because they control the browser, the phone. This isn't great. And then the second thing was, I think probably the most destructive thing they did was when they went against facial recognition. The U.S. had a 3-year lead. They went and started creating laws against facial recognition. And you know who took that lead?
No.
China. Mm. So clearly someone who cares about privacy. And so the number one facial recognition set of companies and in the world is now in China. So thank you to all the privacy advocates for making sure one of the harshest non-democratic governments leads in one of the most important technologies because of that short-term thinking. And I think the EU is doing the same thing. I think the free world needs to band together to make sure that we are leaders in AI, to make sure that our democratic principles are ensconced in these technologies. And we are doing everything to give advantages to countries that have no concern of use of data, privacy, or anything else. I think that is insane. Look what Italy did when OpenAI was there, threatening to shut them down. Think about the logic of that.
It's
insanity.
Yeah, it is. You're almost making sure that your country is left behind and the people in it.
I don't know if you know the phrase in America, cutting off your nose to spite your face.
No.
So you're angry at your face, so you cut your nose off to teach it. Well, you hurt yourself.
Yeah.
This would be cutting out your heart to spite your face. I mean, it is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. But again, I think it's partly the way it's being proposed. And you have to realize a lot of the main winners of AI have a big incentive. I mean, we would have an incentive to say it should be done a certain way because it prevents my competition from coming in. But I just don't think that's the way to win.
But it's interesting that a lot of large companies now are focusing on privacy and understand that the dialogue needs to be there because there's so much fear. But it's interesting because I'm wondering who will that benefit? But I'm sure the big companies will have ways to handle that.
Companies by their nature want certainty because their fear is what happened when Target had a hacker breach. Everyone knew any company in the world could get hacked. But Congress in the United States brought the Target CEO and lambasted him for letting the people's information out. Well, I don't know if you paid attention, but most of the hackers are nation states these days. And when I think about the Cambridge Analytica scandal, that was all politicians involved in that. That wasn't a hack. Those were the politicians buying stolen data happily to win elections.
Right.
Why they were uncomfortable bringing Facebook or trying to make it beyond Facebook.
Right.
And if I look at use of private data, I would say if you look at the European countries, they are all doing offensive things with data.
In what way?
The governments are.
Yeah.
You look at France, they will sit there and talk about GDPR and how great it is on one hand, and then absolutely use and say we have the right to use data to go after people, to arrest them, and to use it for terrorism and everything else without any court overseeing.
Mm.
So I'm sorry, you will not make me feel like corporate companies are the problem. Mm. Governments are.
Mm, that's fascinating. What do you think will happen now? I'm seeing all these hearings and all of that, and will there be a overbody regulation agency, or
we'll find out. I don't know. I mean, the U.S. has historically been smart enough to say, let's wait and see what happens. And then we usually address it when something bad happens. The argument that some of the players like Sam Altman are out there saying is trying to guarantee them a monopoly. He's in a commodity business. I like Sam. He's awesome. And I don't mean to, you know, he's trying to do what's best for him.
Yeah.
But him going out there and saying he's like Oppenheimer is insanity. But what he is trying to do is he's in an area where every company in the world needs money to go raise to build a language model. It's commodity. Mm. You can get all the training data you want on the internet. It's all free. Same thing with images and et cetera. Mm. So what he needs is regulation to prevent other people from coming into his market. Mm. So I hate to say it, but he's out there trying to scare people about what it could do. And we have seen no signs of intelligence. We can see problems like hallucination, which is a bug. We can see problems in software that's called a bug. And people have written many softwares that have caused cars to accelerate automatically and cause damage as well. For someone to say this product could have problems and that because of that we should regulate it, I don't know. We don't have regulation on software development. People seem to do a lot of things with it, and sometimes it's not all good.
No, right. Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
I think that kind of also stopping human progression. You know, when you start to regulate stuff, and also when you, like you earlier, when you talked about acquisitions and those processes where you stop the founders from actually doing new stuff.
Yeah.
It seems like that's something you're interested in, promoting people's opportunities to develop and advance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, even I would say this, even for the people who are most afraid right now, I want you to think back every year of your life. There's not a single year that hasn't gotten better for you. Whether it be through technology, through, every year there's been less famine. Every year there's been, there has been no year that you can look at in the past, even down to discrimination. There has been no year in the past that we've lived that has been better than the next year.
Right.
So the idea of putting a brake on that, just at a moment where it's taken 60 years to get to this place, because of fear-mongering, I think would just be a shame.
Yeah.
I know of no time in history where knowledge is a bad thing.
That is, wow. It feels like we're at this stage in history where now, like you said earlier, we have worked on making everything more efficient, everything a human can possibly do. And we started with the limbs and we're going up, and now we're at the final stage, our cognitive systems, our intelligence, our thinking processes. And this is what is also considered most human of all. Mm. This is us. I wonder if that is also connected with the fear. Are we, in a way, losing us?
Can I position it differently?
Yes.
I'm worried that we're afraid of what our potential is. Because all this technology is doing is unlocking our full potential. Let's go back to Linkshare. Why did that business do so well? Because we unlocked the potential of all these individuals who were never given a shot at building their own websites, their own ideas, their own technology, because a lot of these big companies wouldn't work with them if they didn't have huge scale. And some of them went on to do some of the most amazing things and become independently wealthy or just independent. When we look at the businesses we focus on, it's always about unlocking the potential that's there. And I think sometimes people are afraid of potential. So when we talk about AI, really what we're talking about is unleashing what they can do now, because it's no longer about, I can't find a person to create an image for me. I can't find a writer. I can't find someone who can write code. I can't find all those things that sometimes people have used as an excuse because they have a fear of what they could accomplish or what it would mean or the risks they would take. I think what you're really watching is not the fear of losing your job, but it's that fear that people have when someone says, I'm going to start my own business or I'm going to go off on my own. And the fear they have for you is the fear they have for themselves. And we're getting to a place where I don't have to find a software developer. I don't have to find a place to host it anymore. I don't have to build the computers. Imagine, like, all these things are slowly fading away. And by the way, it's the same thing for professionals. Doctors, we're watching things. If you see the convergence of AI, think about DeepMind's AlphaFold, where they now can predict how proteins will fold, combined with CRISPR, combined with really good sensing of the body with functional MRIs and all these other things. All these things are coming together where we're actually starting to understand how everything works. Mm. And it may not be a researcher at Pfizer who figures out the cure to cancer anymore. It may be someone. Remember, who was Einstein? He was a patent inspector. Mm. Didn't go to one of the top schools and you know, go in a research lab. You know, he wasn't at Siemens doing something. No. He was a patent clerk who figured out one of the most important things in the world. So when you can unlock people and their capabilities, you're going to find people who blew you away.
Yeah. In unexpected places, which is maybe scary, yeah.
And that's what I think people are afraid of.
Mm. It's almost like everything we know is so safe, so we hold on to that.
Or the excuses that we rely on because we're afraid to take the jump or the risk.
Mm. Yeah.
Someone can easily say, oh, you know, Zuckerberg was able to do it because he was at Harvard and he was able to find people. All these things are excuses sometimes for the fear that we have of failure.
Right.
And when all those things are taken away and anyone can do anything,
then there are no excuses.
Kim Kardashian was beaten up for being naked in a video.
Yeah.
She's a billion-dollar heiress now,
yeah.
You know, and all of her sisters are because of social media, the thing that people made fun of. It was the reason someone else didn't do it. Now, I'm not suggesting anyone should take their clothes off and make a sex tape, but my point is that everyone can point out why someone shouldn't have done something, but we're getting to an age where if you want to, you can do anything, and that has never been the case before in history.
It's so exciting.
It is so an amazing exciting moment.
I can't wait for all these inventions, all these ideas getting in out there, and some kid that maybe never would have gotten a chance to share his ideas.
Yeah.
Think about all the ideas in history that we never heard of that came about in a basement or in a kid's room or in a young man's or woman's bedroom.
Yeah.
And
we
never know it.
Out of nowhere. They come up with these ideas, and that's really what we want to unleash.
Mm.
I think when you think about Collective Eye, what we're really saying to people are, one, we respect how hard it is to earn a living for your family and the stress that's around it. Can we help you make it easier? And we think we can.
Yeah.
Two, for their employers and everyone else they work with, they're trying to figure out how to manage appropriately. It's really hard when everything's unpredictable. I think the third thing is we recognize that, look, selfishly, I should be promoting regulation because it'll guarantee me a monopoly. But I don't think that's right for the world. I think responsible AI and a collective AI, you'll see this. We host an event. I should say two things. One, we host an event called Forecast.
Forecast.
Every week we do this. And it's 90 minutes. Anyone's welcome. You can go to CI Forecast, like Collective Intelligence Forecast, CIForecast.com. And you can see every week. We host a Zoom session, 90 minutes, where you can ask the speaker anything. These are some of the most well-known people in the world. Eric Schmidt, John Chambers, Kai-Fu Lee, Fei-Fei Lee. I mean, these are some of the most well-known people in the world. And it's 90 minutes where you get to ask them anything. And we take those recordings, and in our software, we have an area called Upskill, where you can watch them again, and you can share them. And we believe responsible AI is about lifting people up and giving them a path into the future, as opposed to trying to regulate and slow things down for people to catch up. We believe companies have an obligation to help everybody get past their fears by training people and retraining them.
Yeah.
And I think if governments really cared about this, they would be training people, not trying to slow things down. All I see are everyone saying 6 months sabbatical. Let's slow it down. This is 60 years in the making.
Yeah.
6 months, please.
Yeah.
And by the way, none of them are following it.
No.
I see people like Elon out there who are telling people how scary it is. Meanwhile, he's building the largest AI supercomputer out there. He's telling everyone how scary it is because he's trying to scare you away. Because all I can tell you is his cars are the ones that are going to kill people, and he's desperately trying to get self-driving, the first major robots. He's trying to actually build robots. Mm. He's trying to put them in orbit in space. He's trying to like build the most powerful AI with, you know, their own AI computer. And these are things where don't listen to what people say, watch what they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you do that, you'll learn. And I would argue if you watch what people are doing, they're training their people. The winning companies are training them how to embrace AI, how to use it, how to think about it, and they're trying to force it into their organization as fast as possible, because if their people don't understand it, they will fall behind. There were farmers who were left in the end who were trying to figure out why the tractor had taken their job. And there are people who learned what it meant to work in a factory in other places.
Yeah.
And those people who have factories have much better livelihoods than people on farms.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we're hopefully going.
And I guess the educational system too needs to be updated. I mean,
it's ridiculous. Training people to write. The fact that you have to do college essays in a day where there's ChatGPT. What it is administrators think that that's a value. It's no longer a value.
And it also hasn't been in a while. I look at all these people working with children with dyslexia and challenges like that. It becomes this big trauma, and they can't unleash their other potentials because they're so focused on fixing that problem. But we do have alternative ways to access knowledge and share knowledge than through handwriting.
Yeah.
I wonder what education will look like in 10, 15 years.
You know what it does? It also holds people to a standard of mediocrity. Because instead of trying to figure out what each kid has that's special or unique, that's their superpower. And I may be a horrible writer, but what if I'm amazing at Mandarin because my ear can pick up all the intonations? If I'm number one in Mandarin and I sucked at phys ed, or I sucked at math, but I was amazing at Mandarin, why am I not getting into the top schools focusing on Mandarin?
Right.
None of this makes any sense. There's no specialization anymore. And if a kid really wants to be great at something, great. If they want to go into liberal arts, then be great at liberal arts. Maybe you're not great at math. If you want to be a mathematician, why do you care about liberal arts? By the time someone's 18 years old, if they know what they love, then let them go to a place where they're experts at that. But they don't. They look at GPA, which looks at every subject. It's insane.
It's crazy.
And then I think it's why the schools will die. I think what will happen is they'll go on for education in their own specialty.
I think so too.
And this is, by the way, why if you look at you look at Google, they don't hire people out of just universities based on GPA. They look at people who are doing open source projects. And they look at what you created, because a lot of these high school kids are creating these amazing open source projects, and they're going and recruiting them right out of high school.
Yeah, and while failing in classes in school.
And like great sports players are like, why should I go to college and pay this money if I'm going to get a great job right now working for Google? And they're not wrong if that's what they're good at. If they love coding, do they really need to do physics classes? I think they should. I hope they have interest, but they can do it on their own.
And there are other ways to learn. I shouldn't say this, but because I'm an associate professor and I teach a lot. But at the same time, I do, every time I'm standing there and teaching people, and also think what we're doing is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
And also seeing how my daughter went through her educational path, and so many times I would be like, oh, actually, I would have loved to take you out of school and given you the opportunity to learn exactly what you wanted to learn, and also just hone in on those talents rather than spend time so many hours.
Look, if I were a parent, I'd be focusing on the Socratic method to teach kids how to think.
Yeah.
I'd be focusing on social skills, because learning how to manage people, learning how to interact together, especially with remote interactions that are becoming more and more there. I would focus them on training them how to learn, just so that they can constantly learn.
Yeah.
The days of getting a degree and being done with learning are over. You're going to have to learn every year of your life. And by the way, that's also a way to stave off cognitive decline. So we should be happy about that.
Yeah. And it's also fun.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. This is so interesting.
It's a fun time to be alive.
It is, right?
But I just hope we don't end up going down the wrong road. Yeah. So, I think right now, and you talk about people who are in AI, and you talk about where we're going, they really believe in a better world. And they're all doing it. When we started the internet, you know, that early crowd that started there in 95, 96, maybe we were optimistic, and maybe bad actors did bad things. Mm-hmm. But generally, we went in there with the goal of doing good, and we did. There's more good that's come out of it. No matter what you think is bad about the internet, there is way more good that has come out of it.
Right.
And it'll continue to get better.
Yeah, I think so too. I loved what you said about you had that focus on how you need to facilitate training and retraining all the time, how to support learning in others, And I saw that you're also an investor in other startups and supporting new talents and new founders. And how has that been for you?
It's funny, you say supporting new founders. I look at it the other way around.
Okay.
When you are an investor, I'll say this. When I see CEOs of major companies not being seed investors, I think to myself, how will these people survive? Being an investor in other people's companies gives you the firsthand look at an area that you want to learn about without having to do the job. Yes, you're enabling them to build businesses. Mm. And yes, you're providing them connections and insights and things you've learned. But the reality is you're really learning from them. Your job is to learn about a new sector because they're actually living it and they're going to explain it to you. So oftentimes I'll invest in completely areas that make no sense to me, but I know are going to be important. And it's my way of being able to say, when I pick up the phone, can we do a quick phone call and go for lunch and you can teach me? And in those updates that they share with you, the logic that they have, the debates that they're willing to have with you are there to help you understand how the world is changing. Now, if I'm in a big company, I may think, oh my God, it's not going to affect me. But the rate of adoption is so fast that by the time I start trying to realize that, oh my God, this thing, think about all the banks that were trying to figure out crypto. Now, crypto blew up, but it's not gone. It's still a technology that's got value, right? Blockchain is a big deal. But a lot of people don't even take the time to invest to learn about it. And so they think, oh, thank God it's gone. Everything that's gone comes back in tech.
Yeah.
It just comes back in a new format.
Yeah.
And by then they fixed all the problems. And then you thought it was gone. By the time you wake up, it's too late. So I think the best part about all this stuff is by getting the ability to be a backseat or buy a ticket to the ride, I get to learn and I can apply some of those learnings to my own business. If it turns out it's something I need, they help me find the right people. They help me think through my problems because they're grateful that I helped them when they needed it. They're going to be there when I need them back.
It's a mutual relationship. The teacher is not the teacher, it's actually the student, right?
Always.
Mm. That's such an interesting way of seeing it. Like blockchain, are you involved in that?
I'm not involved in blockchain. Okay. It was an area that I didn't have a lot of interest in.
Mm.
For the use cases that it had, I was more focused on AI. And in my area, it's really my main focal point. And in this area, it is moving so fast and so hard. Blockchain was really less interesting to me because it was just a different form of a database. And distributed databases are not a new concept. And the approach they were taking, I thought was interesting. I just couldn't find the use cases. And I think that's been the biggest problem for it. You know, with the exception of crypto, where people were trying to make really gambling bets.
Yeah.
And it was more for a gambler. They're still trying to find use cases. And I think there are some. For example, if you think about how long it takes to clear a transaction in the stock market, if you think about home ownership, there's some really good use cases where blockchain could be really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
They just weren't things I was interested in.
No.
But you're going to find there were some great projects that use blockchain for financial instruments that are much more efficient than the older models, or help us get off of things like the bank still runs on COBOL. So maybe there's a more efficient way. COBOL is a very old software code where most people are dead who know it. But these systems, these mainframes are so big that to rebuild them would be too hard. Well, this may be an opportunity for people to do it in a new way that's much more efficient. So we'll see.
Yeah.
But the challenges of the crypto gambling threw people off of the underlying value of what it has. But it's just not an area that I'm focused on.
So now you're focusing on AI mostly, and you're building all of these intelligent foundational platforms. Or would you call it foundational models?
It's called a foundation model. So I think Heidi and I and Tad tend to focus on things that are look bleeding edge, but are actually much closer than people think. So when you think of those areas, space, quantum, and AI are the three pillars that are non-bio. If you're in the biotech field, you'd have a different area. Just biotech is a different beast because it's regulated. But if you look at the main areas, those three areas, those are the ones that I think we are obsessed with. And so we participate in areas around those.
Space, quantum, and AI.
I sit on the board of a space company called Spire. It's a New York Stock Exchange traded company. We put CubeSats in the orbits. And in fact, I think if we were a government, we'd be a top five government for satellites that are out there. And we do ship tracking, plane tracking, weather data. These are things that when we started the business almost 10 years ago, people said, you know, CubeSats are toys because they're about the size of a large Pellegrino bottle. And we send lots of them in low Earth orbit, and people used to call them toys and make fun of them. And today we are the dominant provider of all those services because of those small satellites. And in fact, now, you know, Elon came out with Starlink. They joked around about these little CubeSats as being ridiculous.
Yeah.
Turns out, no, they're not. They're pretty powerful. But this is an example of where people think about yesterday and not about tomorrow with what the technology is available. And I think if you look at things like even quantum, you'll see lots of changing things going on in quantum that you probably people aren't paying attention to when they should be.
Quantum is also so, I don't know if people think it's too complex to understand, so then people just don't deal with it. And
it's a shame.
It is.
Super interesting.
Yeah.
And it will open up a whole new world for us. So all of these things are so positive. I've never been more positive about what the options are for humanity ahead and how exciting it's going to be over the next 15 years.
I'm so excited. Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
The relationship with your sister.
Yeah.
I don't know of so many people who work so closely with their siblings. There are probably many examples of it, but I don't know personally that many people. And I just find it so fascinating. Like, you guys probably know each other so well, and you know each other's strengths and weaknesses, and you probably built some collaborational processes that really is, I don't know, how is that like? How is your collaborative relationship?
Funny enough, at Linkshare, we worked, we were brother-sister. One of our main competitors was brother-brother. Another ad tech company here in New York that we're really close with was brother-brother. I think what you'll find in a lot of entrepreneurial businesses are they probably grew up in families that were entrepreneurial, where they had to work together their whole lives. So when my father passed away when we were very young, Heidi and I have always worked together. And so a lot of the battles that you would have as teenagers were battles, but you're used to working really well together. And over time, you start to have different areas of expertise that you're good at. I think like all kids, you know, growing up, you know, the oldest is one, this middle is another. You sort of have these different roles they play. And so working together for us has been very easy and very fulfilling. I'm also very fortunate. Heidi is ridiculous. When I mean beyond. You know, I was with the CEO of a Fortune 50 company, and, you know, Heidi went to, you know, go do a phone call or something. And he turned to me and said, "Hey, Steve, you and I are pretty smart, you know, but your sister is on she thinks she plays chess on four dimensions." And I didn't want to tell him that it's actually five, but that he doesn't realize it yet.
Mm.
And it's very true. So it's very easy to work with someone who's that good, especially when you've worked together for so long. And Heidi married a great guy who's a great entrepreneur in his own right. And so it's been really fortunate to have all three of us be able to work together. And the reality is, when I say the three of us, it's really not. My mother's still involved in the business. My niece, my nephew, everyone's involved, because we sit around the dinner table and we talk about everything, and everyone has an opinion and everyone debates it. And, it's a full family affair.
That would be an interesting dinner. And I guess that kind of process of having those conversations over time as well, I mean, it could probably evolve into a dynamic where someone is listening more to than others. But I think in your case, it sounds like there's like kind of input from everyone, and is it a dynamic where you look, listen?
I don't know if you or your listeners have ever hung out with Jewish families, but Jewish families are a little bit
so
different.
Mm-hmm.
There is no filter. Everyone speaks exactly what they want. They'll yell at each other all day long, and then 2 seconds later say, "What do you want for dinner?" We're very passionate about what we believe. We're very blunt, and we believe that debate brings out the best outcome, but that doesn't mean it's personal.
Right.
So if you sat around the table, there'd be five discussions going on all at once. Everyone would be cutting each other off, and everyone would be arguing with each other on whose logic is better.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't make a difference. And if someone's right, they could be wrong tomorrow. We don't sit there and say, "Well, you were wrong yesterday." And if you could basically go to any Jewish family, you will see that same dynamic.
Right.
It is a very healthy dynamic. But if you're not used to it, it could seem very offensive to an outsider, because one, you get cut off. Two, they're arguing with you. Three, they're saying, "You're out of your mind, you're crazy." And then you'll have whiplash when they turn around and go, "Did you want wine with that? I'll get wine." You know, I think it's your favorite wine in the middle of a huge battle.
Yeah.
You don't think anything of it.
No, it's just natural.
Makes for a much easier way to operate a business together.
Wow.
Because no one harbors anything. They vent it, they yell at you, you argue, and you say, "I think you're nuts, I'm leaving." And
yeah.
They'll be like, "Why are you leaving?" And then they'll be like, they won't understand any of it. So it's a really good way to grow up.
Wow, I love this.
Yeah, you love it until you have it happen to you.
Yeah,
you have to get used to it first before you love it.
Yeah, but it sounds amazing. I mean, so honest. And also knowing that you're still a team.
We're always a team, but be prepared to hear things you don't want to hear. Most of those things that you go through your head that you wouldn't tell someone, they will tell you right to your face.
Right. Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And not let it go.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. And I love that you have that relationship with your, not only your sister, but your family.
I had it with my grandmothers. I had it with my grandfather. I had it with everyone. That's amazing. So, yeah, we're very fortunate.
Oh, gosh. Okay. I could have talked to you for hours, but I also don't want to take your time.
No, we're like, good. I appreciate doing this. Thank you for doing this. I had such a good time.
This is so much fun. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me. I love your podcast, and I'm so grateful that you reached out. And for anyone who, if this is their first one, you should listen to all the other ones, because I've listened to all of them, and I love all of them. And I'm so excited to have you here with me today and to be a part of this. So thank you
so much. Thank you.
The conversation with Stephen made me think of the phoenix bird from classical mythology. The phoenix is a bird that could live for centuries and then burst into flames and rise from the ashes with renewed potential for yet another cycle. Humans can also be remarkable in this respect. With the invention of new disruptive tools, new levels of development and prosperity are also unleashed. To me, Stephen is a perfect example of such pursuits. It is hard to predict where we are going from here. But one place to start might be to listen closely to those of us who have had a front row seat to this new rise of AI, and who will contribute to the disruptions of what we know to exist today. For the interested listener, I recommend checking out Collective Eye's website and the weekly CI forecast event they are hosting from the recommended sources. I'm so grateful for the serendipitous moments curated by dear friends that open opportunities for us to learn from the brightest. And I encourage everyone to be bridge builders and facilitate new conversations. Conversations that we are directly a part of and indirectly. One never knows what it can lead to. And that's the beauty of it. Thank you for listening to the Chameleons podcast. I'm your host, Imak Zambrana. Thank you.